Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome everyone to the 16th episode of Dog Eastern Europe. My name is Maciek Makulski, I am co-host of the podcast, and together with me is Adam Reichardt, the editor-in-chief of New Eastern Europe, bi-monthly magazine, and he's also a co-host of the podcast. Hi Adam!
Hi Maciek, and hello to everyone out there. Summer has started, but that doesn't mean that things have slowed down in our region of Eastern Europe. This coming Sunday, July 21st, we have parliamentary elections in Ukraine, so we're going to be watching that pretty closely. For those who've been watching the news, we see Moldova has been making waves with the new government there, so I really hope that we can try to cover these and keep on top of these important issues in the future.
Certainly, and there is a lot of cover for future podcasts. And can you believe that we have already completed 15 episodes of Dog Eastern Europe?
Wow, yeah, 15 episodes. It really has gone by fast. Feels like we just launched the podcast. Of course, we've been doing it now since, I think, the end of November. Yeah. It's great for us that that's been going, and it's really great to have the support and the listeners who are out there.
Yeah, and let me add that with the 15 episodes so far, we have reached over 8,000 downloads, which gives us a strong motivation to continue this project. And yeah. You can find easily all previous episodes on Podbean app, for instance, or Spotify, iTunes, and also at the New Eastern Europe webpage, that is www.neweasterneurope.eu. And last but not least, you can also consider supporting our project by the Patreon website. And those who are interested and can afford it can choose between different monthly plans of supporting, starting from $2. For each plan, there are special rewards prepared. If you like the idea of becoming our patron, just check our profile at www.patreon.com/dogeasterneurope. And we will put also a link below today's episode.
That's right. That's right. And I just want to emphasize to our listeners out there that it's really important that you consider supporting us. It would really mean a lot to have your support. And I do want to thank our patron, our latest patron, Pierre Marmara, who is considered an engaged listener and is providing us with a monthly donation. He gets notifications first when there is a new episode, and we do publicly thank him on the podcast, like I just did now. So if you'd like to be publicly thanked or would like to be the first to know when there's a new episode, please join him and check out the link. As Maciek said, below we'll have, and we can also just give it one more time. It's www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope.
Now, Adam, maybe can you tell us something about the theme of today's episode?
Sure. So I think for those who have listened to our previous episodes, our most recent episode, I should say, the one that we had on Azerbaijan, we recorded the introduction across Atlantic. I was in Chicago at the time. Maciek was in Warsaw. And I was on a study visit, which was funded by the Heinrich Bulle Foundation, the Warsaw office. I am one of the three fellows in their 2019 edition of the Transatlantic Media Fellowship. So I proposed to do research, which I did, on issues related to security attitudes in America on Russian interference in the elections, particularly considering that there are presidential elections coming up next year. And one of the main points of my visit was a study tour of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, which is based in Chicago, as it is in the name, and an interview with the director of the Chicago Council. His name is Ivo Dalder. He's the director, and he's also a former ambassador to U.S. ambassador to NATO. So he's got a, and before that he was a fellow at Brookings Institution. So he's got a lot of insight, a lot of interesting perceptions and perspectives on the situation, security situation, and of course the Chicago Council is one of the institutions that has been researching and doing public opinion data on American attitudes towards security, international security, and especially NATO since for over 40 years. So they have a lot of good data, and it was really great to sit down with him. Mm-hmm. And I spoke with him about several different issues for this episode of the podcast.
Great to have such an experienced guest speaker as we usually try, and I think so far we had really good experts on the matters we discussed, but especially these issues related to security are usually tough and complicated.
Yeah.
Maybe we should give a bit of the background for our listeners before we go into the interview.
And I do want to add, Maciek, that this this is not 100% related to Eastern Europe, as I was in the U.S. and I know we are talk Eastern Europe, but I think these issues of security, and this is something we also talk about later in the interview, are so important coming from this region of Central and Eastern Europe. And the role of NATO that it plays in creating a deterrence from the threat, from all threats that do face the countries in this region.
But the interesting point is that you came there of course as an American and journalist, but I guess it was obvious that for your guest that you're. You came from Poland as well.
Yes, true. And it was interesting for me as well, because I mean, I come myself from the Midwest. I grew up in Wisconsin, which is not far away from Chicago, but I've been living in Poland now for over 10 years. So it was also a very important learning experience for me to catch up and hear about American attitudes on these issues, which we think a lot and talk about a lot here in Poland.
And how people reacted when you told them that you come from Poland and you are interested in this issue related to security? Like, I would like to have a picture of part of the picture, how currently United States like perceive Poland as a security ally of the United States. Mm. Do you have any interesting or did you hear anything interesting in that regard, that the position of Poland as a security ally have increased in some way or it's nothing like that happened?
To be honest, I guess I would start by I don't want to give too much of this interview that the listeners are going to listen first. Yeah. So I'll talk about some other impressions that I had. I think my view or my perspective is that in Poland, I think we talk about these issues a lot more than they are talked about in the U.S. And that's, I mean, for some obvious reasons as well. But Poland is not seen so much, at least from the number of people that I interviewed in St. Louis and Chicago, as number one security partner or ally. Of course, some people were familiar with the topic because there's been some press and media reports about Poland trying to get a permanent U.S. base.
Number one issue for Polish policymakers.
Yeah, it is. Yes, absolutely. But I would say it's not very high on, probably not high on the list for a lot of U.S. policymakers or people who are interested in security policy. So that's a bit of a challenge to I think there's quite a strong difference in the level of awareness among, let's say, Polish public on this issue versus American public on this issue.
I also wanted to say that this is on the one hand huge challenge for Polish political elites, but this is in itself interesting process maybe for those who are not covering Polish politics so closely. We can add that from the beginning of the 90s it was like very important for Poland to join NATO, which happened in the end of the 90s finally. And it was interesting process because there was a political consensus that this is the right direction. Like no matter who was forming the government in Poland, the direction was clear for everyone that joining NATO and the European Union is a strategic goal for Poland. After joining NATO and the EU, and the political scene has been divided, when we talk in general terms, of course, for those who support one or maybe one division line, let me say it like that, was to be more pro-European or pro-American, especially in terms of security. And now it seems that, let's call it like US camp in Poland, like it's getting a bit stronger. And this is interesting because, relying on one partner is always quite risky, but taking into account the historical factor, cultural factor in Poland, this is quite understandable.
I agree with what you're saying, Maciek, but I would also say that probably this topic, for the most part, in terms of mainstream politics in Poland, I would imagine most sides, political sides, would argue for a U.S. base in Poland, even if it does divide some of the Western Europeans' view towards the region. I don't know if you agree with me on that.
That's true, but then we talk about general strategy, yeah, and what is also like. What politicians say publicly, like who is number one, what is the number one priority, and so on and so on. So I think we have seen recently quite some kind of imbalance.
Yeah, maybe there is some divergence in the political
That was my point.
perspective. Yeah,
That was my
for sure.
point. And then what you have said is interesting because it's and it will be all the time some kind of a test, like, is it seen, all these invests are seen in the United States or not? And we can say that so far is not such a big change. So we always have to be careful about, this building alliances,
Right. One thing that's interesting, and when that maybe now to set up the interview. What I found really interesting is that the level of support, I mean, again, here in Poland or in other parts of the region of Central and Eastern Europe, like the Baltic states, support for NATO membership is very high. And after hearing President Trump and their, American First policy, a critical view of the NATO alliance, I was curious, like how high level of support Americans have towards NATO, and one interesting based on the research actually that they do at the Chicago Council, one interesting survey finds that American support for NATO is higher than it's ever been in the history of their surveying on this topic for since 1974. So that's quite an interesting development, and we talk about that during this interview.
Do you know especially when the change occurred? Like, what was the
I
like a
mean,
critical point that it started to change, that Americans started to trust more NATO?
I well, the former ambassador talks about this, what he thinks, what the reason is, but looking at some of the research beyond just what the Chicago Council does, there's I found one Pew Research poll, which from 2016, I think it was, either 2015, 2016, just as Trump was becoming president, that found that 49% of Americans support their membership in NATO. So it's a huge change, because today it's around something around 74-75%. Quite a big change. I suspect it has to do with the high level of attention that it's getting. And of course,
with Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Of course. It is a political issue. It's been politicized by mostly by President Trump, and a lot of people, I think, just because President Trump doesn't support fully the NATO commitments and membership, or questions America's membership in NATO, there is a negative reaction or reaction on that other side.
That's interesting. I don't have a specific number of what is the support level for NATO in Poland and other Central European countries, but maybe it's a matter of the part of the discussion in future episodes here also.
Yeah, so I think we definitely will come back to this topic. I mean, it is such so tied to also generally the situation in Eastern Europe, and looking at NATO's eastern flank, and also issues of hybrid warfare, cybersecurity. I think some of these issues we also will try to cover on the podcast.
Definitely. So I suggest that maybe we can move to the interview right now.
Yeah.
Listen to Ambassador Daladar.
Maybe just before, Maciek, before we get into the interview, I do want to have one disclaimer and clarify that this podcast was done in cooperation with the Heinrich Böll Foundation Warsaw office as part of the Transatlantic Media Fellowship Program for Journalists. I'm very grateful for their support, and I do need to highlight that the views that are in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the Heinrich Böll Foundation's Warsaw office.
Okay, so having said that, let's listen to the interview.
I am here in Chicago at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs with Ivo Daladar, the head of the Chicago Council and the former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Thank you so much for taking your time to meet with me.
I'm very glad to be here. Thanks. Thanks for coming and visiting us.
It's great to be here. So I wanted to ask about overall, maybe starting looking at Americans' view towards their country's membership in NATO. Recent polling actually suggests, surprisingly to me, that American support for NATO's Gallup survey in March found that 77% of Americans support their NATO membership. And I think a recent survey which you did here found that 70% of Americans believe the U.S. should take an active part in world affairs. This is quite an interesting change from just a couple years ago, when a Pew survey found that 49% of Americans only supported their NATO and international cooperation. So why do you think there's been this change? Is there a renewed interest in foreign affairs? Is it a rejection of the American first foreign policy? Or is it just that there has been so much attention more recently?
So first, on the degree to which there has been a change, I mean, we don't see the same kind of massive change when it comes to NATO. U.S. support for NATO has been pretty strong. Now, it is as strong as it's ever been today. So in our survey in 2018, 75% of Americans thought that the U.S. should maintain or increase its commitment to NATO. And of those, 18% thought it should be an increase commitment. And that is the highest it's been since 1974 when we first started polling. So support for NATO is strong in the United States. And it is now as strong as it's almost ever been.
Mm-hmm.
So the question you ask, rightly, is why? And so not only on NATO, but on support for alliances writ large, on support for trade, on support for international engagement, we see Americans being more willing to engage than they have been in a very long time, and in some cases ever. And I think the reason really is that some things that you have taken for granted for a long period of time, when they are questioned, become more valuable. The issue of trade, yes, you can rail against trade until it disappears. And then you find that there are costs in not having free trade. And then you say, well, maybe we need to have trade. You can ignore whether NATO is important or not until you have an administration, or in this case, a president, who starts asking for the first time, really, in 70 years, some very serious questions about the continued American commitment. And it's kind of like oxygen. You don't know how important it is to your ability to live until oxygen disappears. And in this way, when we did our last poll in 2018, and we're in the field right now for our 2019 poll, and I assume it's going to have similar results, what we see is Americans becoming aware that a leading role in the world is important to their security, to their prosperity, and increasingly to their freedom. And as a result, they're going to ask, they're going to be more supportive than they have been in the past in reaction to understanding what it means not to be a leader.
Could you speak a little bit more about your polling? How does it work? Do you look at different geographies or different demographics of Americans?
We've been polling since 1974.
Right, that's
cool. 45 years. We have the longest longitudinal study, so we've asked the same kind of questions over time to see whether there's change. And so that big question that you mentioned, do the Americans want to stay, have an active role in world affairs, or stay out of world affairs? We've been asking that every year since 1974. And in 2018, it was the highest except for one time, 2002, immediately after 9/11, of Americans staying actively engaged. It's a survey of about 2,000 randomly selected folks. It has demographic and regional breakdown. I mean, the reality is the biggest differences among Americans aren't geographical. So it's not that the Midwest is more isolationist than the coasts. There really isn't much distinction.
Interesting.
The real differences are partisan. And Democrats and Republicans have very different views, and increasingly different views on a whole range of issues compared to, say, 15 or 20 years ago, when the difference among Republicans and Democrats weren't that big. But now, Republicans in particular have become, on some issues, particular outliers compared to Democrats, but also independents. And Democrats have become outliers on other issues. And Democrats, it's immigration, where Democrats and Republicans used to have a more or less similar view of the threat that immigration represents to the United States. Among Democrats, that is declined significantly over the past 15 years. Republicans have stayed pretty much the same. But that's where the differences are. They're not demographic.
Interesting.
There's some, you know, some differences. Younger people are a little bit more, and they've always been, more supportive of multilateral forms of engagement and less for the use of force than older Americans. But the real differences are partisan.
And if we think about NATO, specifically NATO, would you say that there is a good understanding among Americans of what NATO is? What is the purpose of it?
There's a reasonable understanding. People understand there are allies, there are friends. We tend to work together when there is a military conflict. We tend to have our allies go with us. Is there a deep understanding of all 13 articles of the North Atlantic Treaty? No. Is there a deep understanding of how NATO operates in Brussels? No. Is there an understanding, and this is the really big question, that this is a defense alliance? And the answer is yes. Now, general support for NATO tends to be higher than, and that's true in Europe too, than support for the willingness to use military force to fulfill the commitment. So we have been polling for the past 10 years asking whether Americans favor the use of U.S. troops in case a NATO ally like the Baltic states is attacked. That used to be less than the majority, and it's now more than the majority. Again, highest it's been, 64%. 64 isn't quite 75%,
right,
so that's
right.
where you see the distinction. But it's high. And frankly, it's higher than most European countries.
And of course, it's well known that Donald Trump had been very critical of some members of the alliance, particularly those who do not pay the 2% agreed or more. And some of that criticism has been taken pretty badly in Western Europe. And we hear some Western Europeans talking about a new crisis in transatlantic relations. Do you think that there is a crisis in transatlantic relations?
So let me separate out the question of burden sharing from the question of the crisis of the alliance, because they're not necessarily the same. Donald Trump is not the first president, and he won't be the last, to make the case that Europeans need to spend more on defense. Harry Truman, in 1952, said the Europeans needed to deploy 96 divisions in order to counter the Soviet threat. So we've been at it for a long time. And in that sense, some Europeans are not spending enough on defense, and they ought to. So there's nothing wrong with making that argument. We've done some polling, interestingly enough. So what's the best and most effective way to get Europeans to spend more on defense? Should it be by threatening to not fulfill the commitment of NATO, or should it be through diplomacy and persuasion? And overwhelming majorities think it should be through diplomacy and persuasion, not by threatening. We even looked at, so how do Republicans look at that question? And there's a difference between Republicans and Democrats, as you would expect. But then if you look at those Republicans who have a very favorable view of Donald Trump, they think you should be threatening. But those who don't have a Republicans who don't have a favorable view of Donald Trump are much more like Democrats and Republicans and independents. So it's the tactics. It's the means by which he is making his case that most Americans don't support. And that gets to the issue of the crisis. Because this is not, in many ways, seen in Europe as just a debate about burden sharing, in which case there are many people in Germany and in other countries who think more should be spent on defense. The real question and the real reason there's the potential now of a crisis is America, is this president committed to the values for which NATO was founded? And those values are strong commitment to human rights, democracy, and the rule of law, and a strong commitment to mutual security, where it is taken as self-evident that Article 5, that the commitment to see an attack against one is an attack against all, is kind of fundamental to the security structure in Europe. It's why countries like Poland joined NATO in 1999. It's why NATO expanded its reach into other countries in order to provide that security guarantee, so countries had the confidence to transform themselves politically and economically in the right kind of way. That was what NATO enlargement was all about. But it was founded on this essential principle that we would be in favor of common defense. That principle has been, for the first time ever, it's the first time since 1949, we have a president of the United States who has put a question mark behind that principle. He did it in May of 2017 when he refused to even endorse Article 5 in front of the NATO new headquarters, at the very time when he's unveiling a monument, the 9/11 monument, at the new headquarters. Which is the only time that Article 5 had ever been invoked to defend the United States. And, of course, he has put real question marks behind Article 5, including in the hypothetical answer of whether the United States would defend Montenegro if it were attacked by Russia, to which his answer was, the Montenegrins are very aggressive people and we don't want to start World War III. You read that in Poland or in Estonia, in Tallinn or in Vilnius, and you say, is this guy, can I count on him? And the reality is that alliances are not only based on capability, on how much we spend on defense and what the defense buys. It's fundamentally based on trust. Governments need to have confidence in the willingness of other governments and other countries to come to their aid when defense is at stake. And if that confidence disappears, the entire system falls apart.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You bring up Poland, which is which has been one of the countries that does spend the 2%, and it's very very interested now in getting more support from U.S. troops, and is looking into trying to get a U.S. base in Poland. What is your assessment of this? Do you think there is a chance that the U.S. would move in this direction? And they agreed recently to increase U.S. troops presence, but. What about a permanent base? Is this something that you think is possible to happen?
So I think the question of a permanent base or increasing capabilities is tied to two things. One is there is always the felt need by the country that feels most threatened and is most dependent on the help of another country. Poland feeling threatened, given what's happening with Putin's Russia, the United States being the principal guarantor of Poland's security, there is a constant need for countries to be reassured about the importance of the commitment. And looking at the physical manifestation of that reassurance. So troops and bases are one way in which countries have traditionally said, we care for your security. We are going to be there when the chips are down. It was Marshal Foch, before 1914, French Marshal, who, when asked by the British, his British counterpart, how many British troops did he need to deter Germany, he said, one, and I'll make sure he's the first one killed. That's how you do reassurance. And then, so, in the question, is that necessary for deterrence? It's necessary, it's more important now, because the President of the United States has put an asterisk next to the commitment that it has made to NATO. So now you want troops to make sure that it's real. Yeah. Is it important to have troops for deterrence purposes? No. Frankly, the difference between a base and a rotating presence is less important than, say, how quickly can you reinforce the defense of Poland, the defense of the Baltic states. What is our strategy? What is our command structure? What is the logistical capabilities? What is the overall capacity of the alliance? How quickly can you get forces, say, from Texas to Gdansk in order to deal with a threat that may be arising or has already arisen? Those are the fundamental questions of deterrence. And frankly, a military base is expensive. By the way, under Donald Trump, there's no way the Americans are going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. So you'd have to pay for it. If you had the money in Poland to pay for a base, I'd rather have that invested in more aircraft, more tanks, more capability than in a base, which, by the way, is just moving troops from Germany to Poland.
Right.
So it's not that you're enhancing the overall American capability. You're just moving it a place. And so we're dealing with psychology rather than real needs. Now, psychology is important, and as I mentioned, you know, when trust is in short supply, physical manifestation of commitments is important. I'm not against it, by the way. Not in favor of it either. I don't think it really matters. Mm-hmm. I think the fact that President Duda, when he was in Washington, was unable to convince President Trump to do this makes it less likely that it will happen mm-hmm. down the line. Mm-hmm. So, nice try. But let's focus on how do we enhance our capability overall.
And how do you assess the enhanced forward presence, which came after the Ukraine?
The enhanced forward presence is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. The physical and manifestation of a NATO commitment, and not just the U.S., but a NATO commitment to the forward defense of Eastern and Central Europe was extremely important. So having the four multinational battalions deployed in the three Baltic states and in Poland, to have the rotating presence of a combat brigade team in Poland and other places, enhancing the air policing of Baltic airspace, mm-hmm. enhancing the naval presence in the Black Sea and in the Baltic Sea, putting a new flag and headquarters, NATO headquarters, in the east, enhancing the land command, I believe, in Poland, as it was agreed to a few months ago, or in the last summit. Those and increasing the commitment to forces and capabilities, the MATIS 30-30-30-30 plan to have 30 squadrons and 30 ships and 30 battalions ready in 30 days for the defense of Europe. Those are things that truly matter mm-hmm. Because they do two things. One, they say NATO is serious about collective defense. And two, they tell the Russians, don't even try.
Right.
And that's what you want to do. So, yes, these are extremely important matters. Far more important, by the way, whether a country is paying 2%, 2.5%, or 1.5% on defense, is that those forces are real, they're capable, they can defend themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is, it's not only new since 2014. This is something that many of us have been working on for a long time. When I came to NATO in 2009, there were no contingency plans for the defense of the Baltic states. They didn't exist. We built them in 2009 and 2010 as part of a review process to make sure that there was no member of NATO that didn't fall under a contingency plan for their actual defense. And now we know why that's important.
What about hybrid warfare? Because this is one of the areas where I think there's a lot of gray areas, where whether or not you can attribute an attack or some sort of hybrid activity to Russia, for example. Do you think NATO is prepared or is preparing some sort of response or capability in order to counter hybrid? Especially if we think about the Baltics, this is where one of the areas is.
So, yes, hybrid is a problem, and we saw it in Ukraine. But there was no one doubted what was going on. We all knew exactly what was going on. And yes, the little green men all showed up, and it was all kind of weird. But we knew what they were rushing within hours. Right. And so hybrid warfare is a problem when there is uncertainty about the degree to which the alliance is functioning well. It's a problem when you have doubts. Worse, when the Russians have doubts mm-hmm. about America's commitment to the defense, mm-hmm. or Germany's commitment, or Britain's commitment to defense of the Baltic states and Poland. If you have a strong, capable alliance that makes it very clear that if there is any kind of attack, there will be a response, then you will deter not only real war, you'll deter hybrid war. No Russian president would, including Vladimir Putin, is going to risk a war with NATO unless he thinks he can get away with it. Mm. And the only time he'll think he'll get away with it is if the alliance is split, if there are big debates about either the Russian threat or, worse, about the commitment of major powers to the defense of the smaller ones. So I'm worried about hybrid warfare only in that context. Mm-hmm. As long as NATO is strong and united, hybrid warfare is no different than actual warfare. It required the Kremlin to risk the possibility that they are found out. Now, they're more likely to push that envelope because it's high for warfare. They can move back.
Right.
But it also means that it is less likely that you will be confronting a war in which you're going to have major casualties and potential loss of territory under those circumstances. Mm-hmm. So we as an alliance need to focus on how do we maintain our unity, how do we maintain our strength and our capabilities. And in that regard, let me just, since we're talking to a Polish audience potentially, playing one ally against the other and saying, why don't you make me the favorite, is not a good thing to do. Because what it does is it splits the alliance. It creates tension. A base here versus a base there. It's more important to have a base in Poland than in Tallinn. Actually not. What's really important is that we're united and strong. And if a base in Poland contributes to that strength overall for the whole alliance, great. But that the goal shouldn't be a base for a base sake. The goal has to be to strengthen the unity of NATO.
Moving a little bit on towards relations with Russia, because this is another area that I'm interested in, and we kind of are touching that.
Yeah.
How is your current assessment of U.S. relations with Russia? Because it kind of seems, especially from the outside, but probably also from the inside, that the White House has one type of relations with Russia, and maybe the rest of the kind of foreign policy experts have different attitudes towards Russia. So how, if countries from outside, allies, are looking at the U.S., and we are thinking, I think tomorrow in Japan, there will probably be a meeting between Trump and Putin, how to interpret this?
So the differences between Donald Trump and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Trump, during the campaign, ran on the idea that a strong, positive relationship with Putin and with Russia was a net positive for the United States. And I'm not going to rehash what may have happened or may not have happened in there.
Sure.
But there's a clear fascination and a clear sense on the president's part that a positive, strong, personal relationship with Putin is a good thing. No one else agrees, including in his own administration. Mm-hmm. John Bolton doesn't. Mike Pompeo doesn't. I have no idea what acting defense secretary Mark Esper thinks on this issue, but I doubt he thinks that's a good idea. Nobody in the Congress, not a single Republican or Democrat, nobody in the foreign policy community agrees with the president on this. This is singular. It is specific to the president. Part of it comes from whatever it comes from during the campaign. Part of it comes from his belief that the legitimacy of his election depends on him denying that the Russians did anything bad. And he sees the argument that the Russians interfered in the election, the argument that his attorney general is now investigating whether this is in fact the case, the conclusion that Putin wanted Trump to win, he sees that as challenging the legitimacy of his victory. It's not, in my view. I think the question of interference and the question of who won the elections are separate questions.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, he's conflated them, as do many of his critics, by the way. And as a result, we have this really strange reality that the president of the United States seems to have a soft spot for Vladimir Putin that is not shared by anybody else. The difficulty that creates in Europe is twofold. One, there are a lot of people who agree with him. And whether it's Matteo Salvini and Marine Le Pen in Italy and France, and much of the right, actually, in Western and Southern Europe, which has a close affinity to Putin, or on the other side, Schröder and others, plenty of people throughout Europe, including now the Hungarian government, who want to have a very strong and positive relationship with Putin. And on the other side, those who, what I would call, have a realistic view of the presence of Russia, from Angela Merkel and of course, the government in Poland and the Baltic republics. What Trump's is doing, he's splitting further that essential division that has been there really for a very long period of time. It's always changed in where it was, between those who think that Russia needs to be confronted with strength and based, and that you can only deal with them on the basis of strength, and those who believe that it needs to be done on the basis of dialogue. And that's a long-standing difference within Europe. It existed before the end, before the during the Cold War. It got bigger in the 1990s and certainly in the last 15 years. And he's just playing straight into this. And what does that mean? Division, go back to our previous discussion, is the one thing that the Russians have been trying to achieve, and the Soviets before them, for a very long time, because that's how they get their way. And so if you are sitting in Warsaw, or you're sitting in the German Chancellery, and you're looking at Trump and what he's trying to do with Putin, you get worried.
And you mentioned the Russian interference in the election 2016. The U.S. is going through another election cycle for next year. Do you think there were any lessons that were learned due to the Russian interference in U.S. democracy? Or are we risking that it could happen again in 2020?
So, yes, there were lessons were learned, is that, in fact, foreign powers do interfere in one's election. The second lesson is that you need to have a united country to deal with that and not make it a political issue. And the third issue is that is exactly what has happened. It's again a political issue. The President of the United States is unwilling to acknowledge that this is a real threat, and in fact is now even said publicly that foreign interference in elections is perfectly fine if it benefits one side over the other. And that is deeply corrosive for the system and makes it much harder to have an adequate defense against this kind of interference, which, by the way, isn't only Russian. It's also Chinese. Yeah. It's probably Iranian. It's probably North Korean. And we need to have a much better capable defense against this. You would think, you would hope, that a country, however divided politically it may be on the question of who should win what election, could unite on the issue that whatever that election is, it ought to be decided by Americans in the voting booth and not by some foreign power interfering into your systems. But that's not the case. Mm-hmm. Congress has not passed the legislation you would want to bolster security of our elections. Reports have it that the Department of Homeland Security, which is responsible for domestic cyber defense, has been unwilling, has been told not to discuss any of this with the president because he would act adversely against it. And so we are weakening our defenses. So the lesson is, we know what can happen. And if you don't do anything about it, it's going to happen again.
Yeah. And it's also a problem in Europe as well.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a role for NATO at all in this?
There's a role in both in strategic communications. There's a center of excellence in Latvia that deals with that. There's of course a role for cyber defense, and there is a new appreciation of the capabilities that one needs to deal with a defense system. The difficulty in cyber, in particular, and to some extent strategic communications, is it crosses the private-public divide, and it's very hard for a military alliance to get involved in private in private business. And the extent that there is a role for government in this private sphere, it doesn't fall to NATO, it falls to the EU when it comes to Europe. And so you have a NATO-EU discussion, as well as a is there a role for government discussion, which means that, yes, NATO should play a bigger role, but it will always be inadequate to the task.
Mm-hmm. Last question, coming back to the 2020 election, how important do you think foreign policy and security issues will be in the 2020 presidential election? Or maybe even the primary, the Democratic primary, which started with its first debates this week?
So if there's no, assuming no big crisis,
Iran, for example.
Like Iran or a worsening of relationship with China, which is a big assumption, by the way. But assuming that we are where we are today, and foreign policy will continue to have a marginal role. That's never an important role in elections. It's unlikely to have it in this election. Unless you can demonstrate that the actions of the president, in this case, because he's the incumbent, have resulted in real fundamental problems for a large number of Americans, it becomes very difficult to make that case. Now, the president may want to try to do this. He's doing it on immigration, which in some senses is a domestic policy issue, but in other senses is a foreign policy issue. And he's doing it on China. And clearly the relationship with China, particularly if we are well into 2020 and we still are having a large trade war, is likely to have a big impact on the economic development of the United States. And in that way might have an influence on the election. I don't think it is going to have much of an influence on the Democratic nomination, other than to say who's the best to, what's going to unite Democrats is who can beat Trump. And the foreign policy, to the extent that foreign policy is an ingredient in that effort, it may have, you know, some influence on the Democratic nomination process. Presumably would help Biden because he has the foreign policy experience over others. But if Biden is the nominee, the overwhelming reason would be because people think he's more likely to beat Trump, not because he has foreign policy experience.
Well, Ambassador Dollar, thank you so much for this conversation, and we look forward to staying in touch with you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you.
That was the interview with Ivo Daldor. We hope that you liked the interview and the whole episode. This is all what we have prepared for you. Adam, maybe we can reveal that listeners can expect next episodes probably on Georgia and Kazakhstan. Is there anything else that we are almost sure to publish soon?
Well, I do think we'll probably take a short break in August, just so that we can all recharge our batteries. We're working at New Eastern Europe also on preparing our next issue, which maybe in the next episode I will get into it a little bit more, since it will be related to our next episode. But yeah, please do stay tuned. And as always, we do look forward to your feedback and your support.
Yeah, well, Ukraine, of course.
Yes, of course. As I mentioned in the beginning, we do have
about Ukraine very soon.
Yes, yeah. The elections, it's going to be changing the landscape there as well. Very important. And Moldova. I mean, I think we would like to try to cover issues in Moldova as well.
Yeah, so that's good that there are always things to discuss here at Talk Eastern Europe. So thank you everyone for listening. Check additional info below the episode, and until next time.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.